It's the Brouhaha Podcast with Steve Jackson and Mark Carpenter.
It is time for the weekly segment of Brouhaha. And fortunately, we're in the big studio now, and we have a multitude of people, and we have a multitude of samples of beers and ales that I am not an expert on, but I am certainly sure that you are experts on. So I'm going to toss it over to my guests.
We have this is Mark Carpenter, and we do have a man who's expert on all the beers that are in here right now, Ken Grossman from Sierra Nevada. We also have Vinny and Natalie from Russian River that are in the studio today to help us out when we get in trouble. And
that means they pass around the beer if somebody forgets what to say.
Exactly. Keep our glasses full.
Exactly. And I really look forward to having this conversation with Ken today. He and I go so far back, I can't remember when we actually first met.
I was trying to think. I remember meeting Fritz, I think, a couple years before I met you, maybe 1978. I was running a homebrew shop in Chico, California, and came down to Oakland for a homebrew conference and hooked up with Fritz on a tour and bought a case of Old Foghorn from him. And that was part of what got me inspired to open my own brewery a couple years later.
Well, you were just the customer we loved then, and we didn't need many of you guys, but it was good that you came in there for it.
Well, back in that year, so 1980 is when we made our first batch of pale ale, November 15th, 1980. And I think I started coming down to bug you and Fritz probably starting in 1979 I first came up with the concept, wrote a business plan in 78, and really had aspirations of being one of the new small brewers in America. And back in that year, there were, I think, only about 42 or 44 breweries in the whole country.
Total breweries, yes.
That was including, the largest to the six small brewers besides Anchor that opened up. I think when Jack McAuliffe opened was 1977.
Yep.
And then between 77 and 81, six of us went into business. And unfortunately, everybody's gone out of business other than ourselves. And Boulder Brewing Company is still hanging in there. But, the brewing industry was so different back then. And it was a huge amount of effort to educate the consumer, to educate the retailers, to even get a wholesaler to want to carry or distribute your beer was really a challenge.
Exactly. And there's a lot of reasons I think you were successful. And I want to get into that history and some of the reasons you were successful. But before we do, I just wanted to talk about your pale ale. It's just a great beer. I was just finished one. I think these days when there's so many people headed towards IPAs or the opposite end of the spectrum into lagers, that the pale ales are kind of being left in the dust, I think. And I think a lot of drinkers are making a mistake. That I think right here in Sonoma County, we have a number of good pale ales. And I think there's an awful lot of them were designed with you in mind. And so tell us about your pale ale and what you had in mind.
And actually, I just gave a talk a few weeks ago, and as part of preparing for that talk, I went back through all my old homebrew recipes and a lot of the test brews we were doing for our first pale ale that we were going to have as our commercial launch. And we actually brewed some IPAs back in late 60s, early 70s. I was homebrewing, and when we started working on recipes for Sierra Nevada, one of the ones that we tested was an IPA, and we thought it was just too strong for the average beer consumer. And our pale ale at the time at 38 bitterness units was a shocker for many people, as it was. So the palate of the American craft consumer has changed dramatically over the years. But we find, at least in our mind, a beer needs to have great balance. And balancing the malt and the hops and having it have a high level of drinkability is really what we're shooting for. And that's what we strive for in our pale ale back in 1980. And it's still a great beer. And, it's been the genesis of what's happened since then in craft brewing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's your comments about the pale ales that, yes, you could have called your pale ale an IPA just as Liberty could have been an IPA. But we both use pale ale, and it's just a fabulous beer. I think it's funny you mentioned balance, and FX Matt would have never agreed with you that your pale ale had balance, by the way.
No, and
that's an inside joke.
Yeah. I think the evolution of what people are appreciating and enjoying in beers is continuing to change. And for a time, it seemed like people were wanting just more and more intensity. And I think there is a sense now that people are trying to get back to a balanced flavor profile,
yeah,
so that you can not be assaulted with the level of bitterness.
Yeah, it turned into a real chili eating contest for a while, huh?
Right.
Now, your pale ale is bottle conditioned. It's still bottle conditioned.
Yep, I think we're maybe the largest bottle conditioned brewer in the world now.
Yeah, I wouldn't
alert,
be surprised.
Since we've got people driving down the freeway of all walks of life, that what is bottle conditioned? Can you tell our drivers out there?
Ken, go ahead. Yep.
So back in 1980, when I built the brewery, all the equipment was fabricated by myself. I welded the fermenters up myself, and the brew house was made out of cast-off dairy tanks and other equipment I picked up at scrapyards. And so we didn't have the ability to carbonate our beers in a pressurized tank. And so we made the call early on that, we're going to bottle condition our beer just like a home brewer would. So the beer contains live yeast and fermentable sugars. And so the final carbonation takes place over about a two-week period sitting in a temperature-controlled warehouse. So the pale ale actually is about a five-week process of brewing and aging the beer to develop the carbonation. And fine champagnes are made the same way. It's a classic style of re-fermentation in the bottle. As I mentioned, Cooper's in Australia,
they're still doing it.
Bottle-conditioned brewer, but I think we're probably making more bottle-conditioned beers than anybody else in the world today.
And I think from the very beginning, you were a real pioneer at bottle-conditioned in this country. And as I remember, you did an awful lot of research and have lessened the actual yeast in the bottle. When you started out, there was actually kind of a small film of yeast in the bottom of the bottle, which doesn't seem to be there now. But
now, there was a large film of yeast in the bottle and a very variable film of yeast in the bottle back in 1980.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We didn't filter, and you may not remember, but I bought my very first filter from Anchor Brewery.
Oh, yeah.
Back in it was your old small little 40 centimeter one.
Yep.
I bought that and your old bottle filler when you moved into the new brewery. It must have been 1982, maybe?
80. 80. Or 79, we moved into the new brewery, 79. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I was the beneficiary of some of your cast-off equipment. And we used to get our malt the same place you did at Bauer Schweitzer Malting in San Francisco. I used to drive my pickup truck down there and get a tote of malt on the back of it and haul it back to Chico. And when they closed, I think probably sometime in the very early 80s,
yes,
we started getting malt from a different supplier, and the protein levels were much higher. And so we started getting a lot more hazes and a lot more variability in our beer. And so we, at that point, started to do a little bit of filtration to remove some of the yeast. So we have a very consistent amount of yeast today compared to what we had in 1980.
Yeah. And there's other advantages to bottle conditioning. You do have live yeast. So in the bottling process, if you have some oxygen pickup, that it can be consumed by the yeast and actually help with the shelf life of the beer. I mean, is that your experience?
Most definitely. And particularly back when before I bought your bottle filler, which was an okay bottle filler, certainly a step up for mine, but not nearly where the technology is today. But we started out with a soda filler, and so there was a lot of oxygen in the headspace of the bottle. And if we didn't have that heavy amount of yeast to eat up that oxygen, our beers would have oxidized.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of a necessity that we bottle conditioned in 1980. We've since now adopted much better processes and technology, and the state of equipment is such that now you're talking about just fractions of a part per million of oxygen getting in the
beer.
But back in those days, it was it was a significant issue.
Let me break in for a quick second here while you're going over some of the stuff. You've been doing this for obviously quite some time. You were one of the very first, and we also don't want to forget Natalie and Vinny here from Russian River Brewing. We're kind of ignoring them, but they're enjoying themselves by having a sip of their own product, so they're having a great time. And of course, we've talked about Pliny the Younger and the success that's been. You had mentioned as far as consumer tastes. I'm curious because that's one of the things that the wine industry goes through is like, well, what the people were drinking 20 years ago and the people who were drinking 20 years ago have changed. What have you seen in consumer preference in the last number of years that you've been in business?
Well, again, as I said, back in 1980, our beers at 38 bitterness units, which they still are, our pale ale is still at 38 bitterness units. But back then, it was a shocking comparison to the domestic lagers that most everybody was drinking. And so today, as people have gotten used to and start to love and get, in some cases, you know, some level of addiction or passion around hoppiness and hops, I think the beer has sort of followed suit. So we produce beers now in the 60, 70, 80 bitterness units, and you can still make a balanced beer at those levels, so they're still drinkable, but you're getting a lot of hop character and flavor that back in 35, 40 years ago was unknown in beer. And the average consumer really would have been shocked, I think, by some of the intense aromatic flavors that we're putting in beers today. And part of it is to do with the breeding of hops. There's been a lot of evolution in hop varieties that bring a lot more character to the beers. Historically, the hops that were grown in America were grown for pretty much German brewmasters' palates, because most of America's brewmasters came from Germany, and they were used to using the more benign or less intense hops that were growing in Hallertau or Saaz in Czechoslovakia.
And our local hop growers, they never had any interest in anything except more pounds per acre, right, or disease resistant or more bitterness.
Yeah, the U.S. hop industry was dominated by the cluster variety for many, many years. I think it was 80 or 90% of the crop up until probably 35 years ago. And it was just grown for bitterness and not for consideration about its aroma. And the aroma came from these German hops with very mild aromas. So that's all changed now. Now America produces most of the strong aromatic hops, and the Germans are playing catch-up. Yeah,
I'm sure you agree that when I go around the world, I say America is the brewing leader in the world. And I used to go to Europe to learn about making beer and European-style beer. Now they're all coming here. And you go to Munich, you can get an IPA.
Yep, yeah, most definitely.
Well, speaking of, you look at the beer we've just poured over there. You just went to Weihenstephan, which is the oldest brewery in the world, and did an Oktoberfest collaboration that our friend, our all mutual friend Tara Nuren, was there when you guys were doing this collaboration. I was so jealous, I can't even tell you. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, that's so exciting.
Yeah, sure. This was a project we started several years ago, and we decided we would try to find a small German brewer who was open to work with an American brewer. And you know, the German brewing industry is usually very insular and not very open to new ideas. But we were turned on to a handful of German brewers who were wanting to explore, wanting to expand, wanting to learn. So we've done now a number of collaborations. This is our fourth with progressive German brewers who want to learn from what America's doing. So we've helped them on making IPAs at their breweries, and they've come and given us input and thoughts on brewing an Oktoberfest beer. So this last one is with Weihenstephan, a very old brewery out of Freising, Germany, near Munich.
It's delicious.
Interesting. Well, I see a tremendous selection of bottles and cans here, and I am waiting for a detailed description of each one and their characteristics and what consumers should look for, depending on their preference. This is Pete Fopiano, and I have a multitude of guests here, all experts in the brewing industry. So we're going to let their expertise inform you, the listeners, as to all these wonderful examples of the craft brewer's art, and let them describe their products.
Well, I was just drinking some of Ken's Hazy Little Thing IPA. Fabulous hazy IPA that it's got some great ballots.
I love that name, Hazy Little Thing IPA. Yes. That's the actual name of it.
Yeah, it is. It's a good IPA. I had it on the show once before because I saw it in the store and I thought I better try this. And so I brought it in, and it's a good IPA.
You picked one up at Willoughby's one day and brought it in, one of our sponsors.
Willoughby's a great place, by the way.
So, yeah, the haze craze has sort of swept the nation.
Boy, has it ever.
I mean, back in, I mentioned the early years when my beers were hazy, I got a lot of complaints. And today people want it hazier and hazier. So
I was going to say the same thing. And I had it because we had trouble getting Liberty Ale clear.
Yep.
And I've had this fantasy of a brewer sitting in his brewery, and he gets a call, and the customer says, "Hey, listen, I'm drinking some of your hazy beer here, and it's not hazy. Is it safe to drink?
I think that will happen.
Yeah, the world's turned upside down, I think. Now, you started in Chico, and I was curious, did you ever think of any other spot than Chico?
Yes, we did. So Sierra Nevada, and I was a climber and spent some time up in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and so I wanted to look at putting a brewery in the Sierra Nevada mountains. So we actually had a site in Nevada City at one point that we were considering, and then it was, well, there's snow and there's no sewer plant that can handle our wastewater, and so we started looking at other communities, and we were living in Chico at the time, but we were wanting to move somewhere else to start the brewery. San Luis Obispo, I went down and checked out. We thought we wanted to be near a university town for the culture, and we ended up in the end saying, well, we've got a good thing going here. Let's just stay here. So we ended up finally going back and saying Chico was the town.
You know, there's many reasons why a business is successful. It's not just one thing. And I think Chico was certainly part of it because you had all the students there at Chico State. And I used to run into graduates of Chico State around the country that carried Sierra with them. And especially in the restaurant business, one of the owners at Tadich Group. Grill. You guys got us kicked out of Tadich Grill because he was from Chico State.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It's all part of the game, right?
For those that don't know, Mark Carpenter was with Anchor Brewing for 40 years. So when he's saying that got us kicked out of there, you're talking about Anchor Brewing. Beer.
Yeah. Anchor Beer, 45.
I've been doing this now for I'm coming up on 38. 38 years, and Mark and Fritz were my mentors back, way back. So
I think we both agree that we picked great career paths.
We have.
I've never an owner, but it's just it's been a fabulous career. It's such a we're in the fun business.
Yeah,
you know, here we are at a radio station drinking beer and having a good time. You know, old friends getting together. I mean, it couldn't be.
It doesn't get any better than that.
It could not. It would be hard getting better than that.
You're destroying the illusion that we're all serious journalists discussing in-depth topics here. I mean,
we've worked very hard at our craft. And drinking it is part of that.
I want to bring that up, especially when you're talking about water and water treatment plants and things. When Tara Nurin and I from Forbes went out there to tour the place and got to meet, we had lunch with your daughter, Sierra, who's great, and she's one, like, your son and daughter kind of, running things now, sort of, right? Or that's later on. You are very sustainable. The whole brewery is full of solar. The bottling line's run by solar. You're doing the EcoVolt wastewater, right? And I was just so impressed by how
not
something.
We don't have the EcoVolt, but we do have our own anaerobic digesters at both of our breweries. And actually, our brewery in North Carolina, Mills River, it's the only lead platinum brewery in the U.S. Lead platinum production.
And what does that mean?
So it was built to the highest sustainable standards during construction. Mm-hmm. So the use of materials, the recycling of construction materials during the building. And then it also has a lot of energy generation as well as water conservation. Mm-hmm. We've got about 500,000 gallons of water storage for stormwater. So we collect all the water off the roofs, and it's used for irrigation, toilet flushing. There's no potable water used for that. So it's in North Carolina, they have too much water, unlike California. We get a lot of rain out there. So we manage the stormwater efficiently out there.
Yeah, it really is an unbelievable sight, and that I think that's a second part of your success is the fact that you are such a good engineer, self-taught engineer, especially in the beginning, building your little brewery to start with was all home built.
Yeah. I studied physics and chemistry in college, and then when I decided to open a brewery, I went back to the junior college and enrolled in welding and refrigeration classes and electrical wiring and business classes, everything I thought I'd need to run a business. So, I did all the welding, all the refrigeration, all the plumbing.
I remember.
And all the brewing.
Talk about your first louder ton.
Yeah, well, my first louder ton, I couldn't afford to buy perforated stainless. I was out of money. And so I drilled thousands upon thousands of holes through, through the bottom with a hand drill over days. My teachers were like, why don't you just buy perforated metal? I don't have any money.
And you did this where?
At the junior college.
Well, you do what you have to do. Now, for those of you who were listening closely, you heard the popping of a cork a few moments ago, and yet another bottle of something very interesting has been opened.
By
Natalie,
Vinny,
tell us what you just opened.
Yeah, let's have Vinny tell the story.
Yeah. Okay. So we just popped a bottle of Brux. Brux is a collaboration that we, Natalie and I, did from Russian River with Sierra Nevada, and specifically Ken and his son Brian. Brian's one of our closest friends, and Brian just texted me and wanted me to tell you that you have a face for radio, Ken.
Sure he did.
Yeah. And I said, well, I'll tell the listeners if I can get a word in edgewise. But so Brux is a Belgian-inspired beer that we added and then we're going to get into the geek alert here, Brettanomyces. For those in the wine industry, they know Brett as an enemy of wine, in that it is it's basically considered a wild yeast. We added Brett to this beer on purpose to give it a really fruitiness, a spiciness. Jasmine is often described in the aroma of a beer using Brett. Yeah, roses and violets, Natalie just said. So this is now 6 years old. So most beer, 99.99999% of beer, should be consumed fresh. But there are beers that you can age, and Brux is one of them, because the Brettanomyces continues to ferment. And it works at a snail's pace and works and just makes beautiful, beautiful flavor.
It really has. This is the first Brettanomyces beer that I could say that I really enjoyed. It's either a mild form of Brettanomyces or it's it has aged well.
And there's good and bad Brett. There's polluting Brett. There's a lot of Brett, and that tastes like you know you're licking the Goodyear tire. You know, you're at the tire shop, and that smell, that's a bad Brett. But when it's good, it's spicy and flowery and really nice and has amazing ageability. I like to think that they built Mills River, their North Carolina brewery, because the collaboration was going on just as they were designing it. And just in case Brian and I screwed up Chico, they could just push a button, Chico would fall into the ground, and they would have a brewery in North Carolina. One of my other favorite beers that Ken did, and Sierra doesn't do a lot of collaborations like Russian River, but for their, I think it was their, was it the 30th? Yeah, they did several of them, and one of my favorites was called Ken and Fritz. And,
so we have a bottle here.
I'm going to let Ken talk
it's
about it.
It's over 3,000 days old.
All right.
I do the
very
math.
Good. Very good.
Get the cork out. So.
Yeah, I was there for the birth of that, or talking about it, or not the birth, the conception.
So, you and Fritz came up a couple of times, I think, and then we came down to the party at your brewery.
And Natalie and I were at that party, and that was an incredible night. Fritz and Ken just bantering back and forth, and it was so great to hear the stories of both breweries.
So this beer should be also one that ages very well. I have not had one in 4 or 5 years, so. But I think it was amazing when it was fresh, and it continued to taste quite good as it aged, so I think it's going to be good.
Well, I'm looking forward to trying it.
Sure.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. No, I'm going to interrupt for a quick second, just for the benefit of our listeners.
Sure.
Well, you mentioned the aging beer, which, of course, you know, people are used to aging wine to have it, you know, achieve its peak flavor. If a consumer wanted to age this beer, how long would you recommend that they age it for to you know, really have it be at its peak?
Well, very few beers are better with aging. So let's start off there. So particularly beers that are really hop forward. So an IPA or something, normally you would not want to age. You'd want to drink it fresh because you're those delicate hop aromas and a lot of the hop flavor starts to degrade. Not that it won't still be hoppy and bitter, and not that it won't be safe. It's totally safe to drink.
This is what it looks
but
like.
A lot of the aroma will degrade, and you won't get the pungency in the beer. Mm. So there are certain styles, and you know, Brett beers for sure, but also dark, malty beers that are based on malt body rather than on hop character to preserve.
I think you get on the dark beers, the imperial beers like this. It's an imperial stout. You start when it ages, you start getting like notes from an aged sherry. Maybe like this, I'm getting like raisin quality, like a raisin-y quality, almost like a rum would have, and sherry. And those are classic flavors that are just fine in the wine industry. And so you can carry some of this over into the beer industry.
Part of the reason this was the beer is that Stout was Ken's first beer, I remember.
Yeah, Fritz and I actually were trying to figure out what we were going to brew. And I said my very first batch of beer, November 15th, 1980, was 5 barrels of Stout. And ground the roasted malt by hand and stirred it in with a canoe paddle. And that's how we brewed back then. And Fritz had the story of there was a bar down the street from the original Anchor Brewery when he took over, and he was struggling to figure out how to make great beer when he first bought the brewery. And he would go down and drink, I can't remember which stout it was, but it was an imported stout. It wasn't Mackeson's.
Yeah, I think it was Mackeson's. Yeah.
That he would go down to this little pub at the corner and drink it, and hoping one day he could make great beer like that. And so we decided, yeah, stout sounds perfect.
Yeah, and we did make our porter, which is our first beer other than steam, because we had a fake dark steam that was made with caramel coloring. Fritz had inherited when he bought the brewery, and so that's why we switched to the porter.
And, Ken, what was the very first beer brewed at Mills River?
It wasn't 5 barrels, but it was stout, yes.
Yeah.
And actually, the very first batch brewed in Chico when we moved to the new brewery in 87 was also stout. So we've had that tradition, and I just got my old brew house back. So the brew house that I hand-built back in 1980 went up to Mad River Brewing.
Fabulous.
Along with the old bottle filler that came out of the brewery.
Yeah.
And you guys bought it from the Siebens Brewery in Chicago.
In Chicago, yeah.
And,
it made it around.
Which was reputed to be Al Capone's, one of his breweries during Prohibition.
Oh, I hope that's true.
You told me the story, or Fritz did. Yeah. It might not be true. It's a good story.
You know... And you mentioned moving into the new brewery with the same location you are now, which is greatly expanded. But I was always at your old brewery. So I was always jealous of your machine shop. You know, you had a mill and a lathe.
I had a Taiwanese mill and a Taiwanese lathe.
Yeah,
which was a huge spend for me. But I was making all my own parts and fittings.
Yeah, we had a welder and a pipe threader. You know, but anyway, but at the new brewery. You built a pilot brewery that was unbelievably impressive. I think it was 10 barrels, is that correct?
Yep.
And it was not just a pilot brew house. It was a pilot brewery from start to finish, where then you could take that beer and send it to be bottled or racked or whatever. Yep. And because of that pilot brewery, you started your beer camps. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Beer camp.
Tell us a little bit about the brew camps. I'm really curious, were there any of your beers that came out of the brew camps? Anything came out of there that you really were happy about?
Certainly a lot of development of new brands have come out of the beer camps.
Yeah.
We're getting into the final moments of the show, and we are going to be winding up our segment on Brouhaha today. We've talked about numerous different issues, but I'm going to, toss it over to Mark for a bit before we end the show.
Very good. And I've got one question here. We're running out of time. So I want to talk to Ken a little bit about the fact that he stayed in business all this time, that there's so many breweries these days that have sold off to other companies that people have gotten in, and then they have an exit policy or exit strategy. And Ken's strategy was to get the family involved. And I think that's just fabulous. You keep your kids close to you if you're supplying the money for them. So tell us about that, about how which kids in the family wanted to be in, which didn't, and how that's all going.
Well, we didn't push any of them to be involved. My oldest child, Sarah, named before the brewery. So she was named after the mountains before we started the brewery. She worked her way when she was in junior high school and worked as a dishwasher in the restaurant and worked many jobs, including working in our maintenance shop. She sharpened drill bits and did repairs and maintenance with my team out there.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yep. And then, did merchandising out in the market and then spent a stint of time doing sales and work out with our sales manager. And So she's in Chico. And then my son, who initially did not want to work at the brewery, he was going to be a police officer, he thought, and went to criminal justice school.
Until he got shot at.
Until he got shot at, yeah. And then decided, well, maybe the brewery business is,
yeah.
is
not so bad.
Yeah. And so he's out in North Carolina, so he was part of the team that moved out there in 2012 when we broke ground. And so he loves it out there and has been involved in a lot of aspects of the business and now is in charge of our restaurants. So we've got two of my three children. My middle daughter decided it wasn't for her, and even though she worked in the lab and did stuff when yeah. she was in school, having three siblings in the business seemed a little much for her. But the kids are, I think, are enjoying it. It's, you know, challenging times. We've certainly had the opportunity to sell our business. You know, there's been,
of course,
a lot of people knocking the door over the years. But I didn't get into the brewing business to make a quick buck and sell out. I had a passion about beer, and I started brewing at a very early age and loved it. And it's really been, you know, part of my life, and I've enjoyed. Building a brewery, or building many breweries now, as it turns out, and it's been a fun ride. And if the next generation can pass it on to the next generation, that'd be great. But we're in an interesting time in the U.S. brewing industry. There's close to 7,000 breweries today.
Yeah, and it's like 4,500 of them in the past 5 years.
Yep. Yep. And we're competing against multinationals. The craft brewing segment has been one of the only growth parts of the U.S. beer industry for a number of years, and so global brewers have bought into it because they haven't been able to grow their part of the business and see that craft is a segment that's had some growth opportunities, so they've purchased a lot of breweries.
Yeah. Can I just chime in? And for
sure.
Natalie and I, it's staying independent is something in our DNA, but we've always been inspired by Sierra and Ken and his family, and we're dear friends.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're part of our inspiration, and we got to walk Ken through our new facility today, which we're going to start brewing at next week, hopefully. And a huge inspiration came from Ken and his family, and all that they do, and there's the staff, and Sierra Nevada, it's not just about the quality of their beer, it's how they treat their employees and run their business. It's sustainable, but they also don't get on their soapbox and shout it out either. It's just what they do because it's the right thing to do, and that's Sierra Nevada for you, and it's why we always have pale ale in our fridge at home.
To say that everywhere I go in the world, though, all three of your breweries, I mean, I've been to like Lithuania and places like that, and they all are like, Anchor, Sierra, Russian River Brewery, because I live in California, and that's like, when I tell them I live in, Northern California, they know. Poland, Lithuania, everywhere around the world, Shanghai. I mean, you guys all have some pretty fantastic legacies going on here.
Well, for me and Vinny, that's certainly a huge honor to be lumped into the category of Anchor in Sierra Nevada. So thank you.
I mean, I remember starting to make IPA at my first brewery, Blind Pig, and the two inspiration beers that Mark mentioned was Sierra Pale and Anchor Liberty.
Wow.
And those were, in the day. And now it's easy to look at those beers and they seem pedestrian. But at the time, those were epic, legendary, over-the-top, hoppy beers that are very mild compared to today, but they're still both beautiful
compared
beers.
To today's tastes. I think that, quite honestly, if I go buy a Liberty Ale or go buy a Sierra Pale Ale, every time you open that bottle and you drink it, it's such a pleasant experience. Yeah, they're still great beers, and people shouldn't forget about them because these are fabulous beers.
There's nothing like taking the tour at Anchor and seeing all those open top fermenters. That is a marvel in and of
itself.
That's
one thing we didn't get to talk about, but both Anchor and Sierra Nevada have been. Truly traditional brewing methods, whole hops, open fermenters, copper brew houses. And the Brewers Association has never given anything towards brewers who brew with real traditional methods. And it drives me nuts. And I'll tell you, if Ken wants to come back here someday, we could easily spend another hour.
I think you should
going over lots of
set
stuff.
Set up 3 or 4 hours, and we can.
That's it.
You might need a couch after.
Tell us when you want to come back down here. I'll arrange it.
I would love to do it again. It's been fun.
That'd be super fun. That's
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah,
this has been a fascinating. I have to thank all of you or so, because I don't pretend to be an expert on the brewing industry. Correct me if I'm wrong. My perception is that a lot of the brewing industry, especially the craft brewers, are kind of where the wine industry was a few decades ago. It's giving something new and different and unique that the customers have never had before, and they're responding to it. And, you know, you mentioned about, Vinny, about how Sierra Nevada and all your breweries have stayed in business all this time. To me, the essence of staying in business and being successful is offering a quality product at a decent price, treat your employees well so there's loyalty, whatever, and reward them or so, and the public will respond. And, I mean, certainly Sierra Nevada is known throughout the world. Anchor is known throughout the world. And Natalie and Vinny, we've had you on numerous times talking about the phenomenal success, not just of Pliny the Younger, bringing people from all over the world, literally, but also, too, when I drive down 4th Street, there is always a line out in front of Russian River Brewery.
It's going to be so big now, though.
And also now you have the location in Windsor, too, that you're going to be expanding.
That's
so, again, this is something that the public has responded to. You've created a different product other than just going into Safeway, picking up a can of, you know, generic beer. I'll just not use the name. And people have thought it's great. So, I mean, you may be pioneers, but you've done an excellent job in getting the public to realize that there's more to beer and more complexity, more to ales than I think they ever thought possible.
As my friend Jim Fristo used to say, chicks dig us, guys want to be like us.
Okay, we're gonna leave that as a final note here. We'll just think that. I want to remind
cheers,
you that
everybody.
it was
cheers.
Mark who said that, and it was not me, but I'll give him credit for it. So anyway, I have had a great time hosting. I want to thank all my guests, particularly those who are just toasting each other and having a fine time here drinking ales. I'm sorry you can't join us, but thank you to everyone. Steve and Mike will be back very shortly.
Drive safely.